Obviously, we've read the record excerpts. We've not read the record. Please, if you would, get to your most important points very quickly. 20 minutes is just simply not a lot of time. Tracking, our time tracking system here, green light, you can argue, yellow light. 2 more minutes, red light, we expect you to come to a close to your presentation. First case, United States versus William, Ms. Fuentes. This is Bexar County Day, huh?
Yes. Well, yes, it is. Good morning, and may it please the court. Carolyn Fuentes for the appellant, Maria Williams. Mrs. Williams raises 2 issues on appeal. She challenges the sufficiency of the evidence to convict her, and she contends that the sentences imposed by the 21-month sentences imposed by the district court exceeded the statutory maximum for her offenses of conviction. I'll address the sufficiency claim first. To convict Mrs. Williams of forcibly assaulting, resisting, impeding, obstructing, or intimidating a federal officer in violation of 18 United States Code Section 111, the government was required to prove that she attempted to injure or threatened to injure military police officers Putman and Harris.
Why couldn't she just resist arrest, which she agreed, she admitted to the FBI agents that she did resist arrest?
The statute requires that all those actions, resisting, impeding, obstructing, all of those things have to amount to a simple assault or they don't violate the statute. The first case in this circuit that reached that conclusion was United States versus Nunez in 1999. And I'm going to quote what the court held about Nunez. The court said, what Nunez said about the statute. The court said the statute creates 3 separate offenses, to wit, resistance by means of simple assault. So it's not just resist arrest. The court has interpreted the statute to mean resistance by means of simple assault, more serious assaults, but not involving a dangerous weapon, and assaults involving a dangerous weapon.
Ms. Fuentes, the problem that I have here, let's talk about the facts of this case, because I think both sides tend to ignore what's against them. Number one, there's evidence that at least one of the officers got a bloody nose. There's admission that she resisted arrest. There's admission that she was flailing all over the place. And resisting arrest, putting handcuffs on, I think on this record, a jury could find that there was an assault and a violation of the statute. What bothers me, however, is this. The indictment, the instruction, are both misdemeanor instructions. Now, I understand the government's point that you can tack on, sentences and make it up to the guideline. But once you cross the line from a misdemeanor to a felony, something is wrong. Something is horribly wrong in this case. And it seems to me that that's where you have your strongest argument, because I think there was contact, okay? Well, and now, the second officer, they didn't have a bloody nose, but I think, if we look at the record, there's probably something there about contact. Maybe wrong, but the way this thing was tried gives me great, great pause. Now, probably this question should go to Mr. Gay, but I want you to focus on that, because that to me is really important here.
Of course, we disagree about the sufficiency, but I'll go to our second argument, which is the sentencing argument. The government concedes there was error. They concede that error was plain. As the court points out, it's very clear that she was indicted for a misdemeanor, but she has suffered felony punishment. And the government argues that the only reason not to vacate and remand is that, number one, Mrs. Williams' substantial rights were not affected, and number two, the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of the proceedings will not be adversely affected if she stands convicted of felonies, if she's punished for felonies and stands convicted of felonies, although the jury only convicted her of misdemeanors.
Now, why Wasn't there an objection at sentencing, Ms. Fuentes?
I don't know. I really don't. The prosecutor, the defense attorney argued this case as though it were a misdemeanor case. He argued this was accident. That goes to my sufficiency.
There's flags of misdemeanor all over, but there's also flags of felony. It's a district judge. It is, 12 people all the way. Now, I'm not sure that that's a waiver on your part or blah, 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 the argument that's made. My Lord, this is so basic. It seems to me.
I agree, Your Honor. I cannot tell you why the defense attorney did not object.
Was the defense attorney hired or appointed?
No, it was appointed from the public defender's office in El Paso. And again, I cannot tell you why. But the fact is
that's really not sufficient, because you need to know the record. You need to know explanations of questions that we ask.
Well,
it's a pretty monumental issue.
Ms. Wentz, let me just say that yesterday we had two people that have come here from either the government or the public defenders, and they always tell us the same thing. We're appellate lawyers. We don't know blah, 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 blah. And, at least when we think that this is such an important thing, you need to tell your heads of your agencies that we really need answers. And if you're going to send us appellate lawyers, then those appellate lawyers have to know the answers, they have to know that trial record.
Well, then it may be more accurate for me to say the record does not reveal the reason. And so when I say I don't know, we're limited to the record on this appeal. And the record doesn't show why the defense attorney failed to object. That is why I can't answer the question.
And see, that hurts. That hurts you. And
it does, hurts your but it's it, not, I guess I want to clarify a couple of things. It's certainly not waiver. Under Olano, it might be forfeited error, but it's not waiver. It's a failure to object, as the court itself has noted. A failure to object is the forfeiting of error, which subjects it to plain error review. There is that plain error is met. Error is plain and clear. Number two, her substantial rights were affected. The court imposed sentences of 21 months. It cannot impose sentences of 21 months. If this sentence is vacated, the court will be limited to sentence of 12 months on each count. In addition, she got 2 years of supervised release.
What's the statutory maximum?
For supervised release? 1 year.
Statutory maximum for the
for a misdemeanor. 1 year.
For statutory, misdemeanor, 1 year.
For and misdemeanor, that, 1 year.
And that's very clear in the statute itself.
Correct. That's what the statute says.
Ms. Fuentes, the you need to at least articulate, so we can tee this up for Mr. Gay, United States versus Cotton, and how you would distinguish that, because that I'm sure. I hear United States versus Cotton already coming from Mr. Gay's mouth, so let's get that
Cotton,
out right quick.
Cotton is distinguishable, I think, very easily from Mrs. Williams' case. Number one, the point that the court has made earlier, and that is Cotton just increased the amount of time, and I hate to say just, it increased the amount of incarceration to which the defendant was subject, but it did not make the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony. And as we pointed out in our briefs, that is a very, very important line. In addition, the government really hangs its hat on this point, I think. The government says there was overwhelming and undisputed evidence of the felony assault, but that is incorrect, because what must be proved at the very least, even if we were dealing with the felony of assault by physical contact, the court must at least come to the conclusion that the physical contact was not accidental. And for that, I'd refer the court to United States versus Dombrowski. It's cited in the government's opening brief. It's unpublished, but it is a Fifth Circuit case, and it points out that in an assault by physical contact case, which is what the government says it proved, the government has to show that the accused intended to assault the officer. Any physical contact is enough, the court in Dombrowski said, but there was no assertion that the physical contact was an accident. In this case, we have a clear assertion that the physical contact was an accident. And in fact, military police officer Putman said, I don't think she intended to hit me. So the evidence is not overwhelming and not uncontroverted as to that point.
The problem is she intended to resist arrest, and she intended to move her arms and the loaded word resist, you know, what does that mean? In the context of what happened here, where they moved to a fence or something and they couldn't put her thing, and then she you know, it just seems to me at a minimum there.
Under the dictionary definition, I think she resisted. Mm-hmm. But under the legal definition by which this court is bound, she did not. And there's a trilogy of cases out of this court that make that very clear.
Is the evidence here sufficient to find resistance, to find intent through the resistance?
No. The intent has to be to cause bodily injury or to threaten bodily injury. And the evidence was not sufficient to show that. The causing bodily injury, and I think the court's focused on the right testimony, it's everywhere here. When Sergeant Eichmann, who was observing the entire scene, was asked at page 316 of the record, when you say she was swinging her arms, was she swinging her arms to strike the officers? Answer, no, she wasn't swinging in the direction of the officers. So there is no evidence, and in fact, countervailing evidence, that there is evidence that she did not intend to strike the officers. And because the law requires an intent to injure or a threat to injure, that must be thrown. That must be shown. But on this record, it is not. And in fact, I think
Counsel,
yes.
I would have thought that this statute would have precipitated a form of trial that would have presented to the jury the fact that some conduct would be just a misdemeanor and some would be a felony. Does that not occur?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I think in United States versus Nunez, that point was made. In Nunez, the indictment...
You mean that the jury has no role in making the ultimate decision about intent to harm? I would have thought that was a clear, obvious...
I must have misunderstood the question, Your Honor. You are correct. The jury absolutely has a role in determining whether there was an intent to injure.
And was that done in this case? Was there any...
The instructions are less than clear. In one part of the instructions, the jury is told... it's at page 137 of the record. The term forcible assault means any intentional attempt or threat to inflict injury. So they are, in some sense, again, the instructions are not a model of clarity, but they were told that they had to find intent.
Well, the intent is one element, but it would seem to me that another factual element is this: the second clause of that statute, which says if there is physical contact, then the punishment is...
Yes, and that they were never...
...different from what it was under whatever is the meaning of the word simple assault.
Correct, and they were never instructed on that. And that is why a misdemeanor only was charged, because the indictment did not accuse... did not say there was physical contact. The instructions did not require the jury to find physical contact.
Was there a grand jury indictment in this case?
Yes, there was.
And how does that occur?
Well,
I didn't think the grand jury...
The record does not show why they went to a grand jury.
A grand jury for a misdemeanor offense. That's what the indictment... Yes. It doesn't allege contact.
I will agree that both parties below... and I think I can say this from the record, were confused. And I'm not certain that either knew what they were going forward on. And I think
Ms. Fuentes, how many are there a lot of cases in El Paso these days?
Yes.
Or judge? What,
yes,
over
there are many,
1,000?
Many cases. I couldn't tell you the numbers, but I know it's among the highest in the country.
Sure. That's probably the way too many things to think of.
I would just point out again with respect to the Cotton case, there's also some argument to be made, although I'm not certain how strong it is, that the intent, the level of mens rea changes when it's a misdemeanor or a felony. And Ramirez is the closest case that will tell you that. If you are charged with the more serious form of assault, assault by physical contact, which was the Ramirez charge, then you don't have to intend to show bodily injury, but you surely must intend to show the physical contact. And I would point out with Officer Putman's testimony, he testified to the jury, I don't think she meant to hit me. Yep. It was his view that she did not intend to hit him, that it was accidental.
Forcibly resist arrest.
Correct.
Right. And you get hung up on the assault. We still have other components to this.
That's what I disagree with, Your Honor. That's what I disagree with. The law says where the acts in violation of this section, all right, the act is resistance. Where the acts in violation of this section constitute simple assault. To constitute simple assault, there must be an intent to injure or an attempt or threat to injure. And my time is up.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Fuentes. Mr. Gay.
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel.
Since I've already taken your name in vain several times.
From the Western District of Texas. Well, I believe to answer the most difficult question is that I think the way, from why I read the record, is that we proceeded to the grand jury with an indictment that failed to allege a required element to prove the felony. We went to trial before a district court judge and a 12-member jury. We sentenced all without objection. It appears to me from reading the record that everybody believed that we were prosecuting a felony. Unfortunately,
are you the prosecutor?
I was not. I am.
you come like those yesterday, King.
Well, I'm
an appellate lawyer. I don't know what happened at the trial court.
Well,
where they were confused, as opposing counsel has alleged.
Confusion, there's certainly confusion as to this. Number one, the indictment failed to allege bodily contact, which was...
There's got to be more to this story. I mean, there has to be something else going on that could engender the attention and the... I mean, we don't understand the factual basis here, why this woman was such a target.
Well, Miss Williams,
but there was a pretty serious history there.
The pre-sentence report gives you some light there. You know, she had previously been convicted of a felony for the death of her child, had escaped from prison, appeared on America's Most Wanted. She has some history, which is reflected in the pre-sentence report. Which, that said, this case involves an indictment which failed to allege an essential element. And so that brings us, as Judge Garza commented, to the Supreme Court's case of Cotton. And Cotton was a case that dealt with this huge problem that occurred when the court had the intervening decision of Apprendi. And essentially what Apprendi said is a fact other than a prior conviction that leads to an increased statutory term must be proved and submitted to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. So we had this huge quantity of cases, drug cases, other cases that were in the system where none of that had been alleged in the indictment and none of it had been found by the jury. And the court dealt with the situation that many defendants were going to get a windfall, even though the government proved and the jury would have found and the grand jury would have indicted based on the evidence the triggering quantities.
But the difference in quantity of drugs does not make a difference between misdemeanor and felony.
That is correct.
So that this is a real problem case. Cotton says, fine, if you the record proves what was the real discussion about the quantities of drugs, you ought to get off. But here we've got the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony, and that is striking in my view.
Well,
has a similar case ever been heard?
Not to my understanding, Your Honor.
You couldn't find one. My clerks couldn't find one.
That's correct.
So we're talking about a res nova of what do we do when the essential element left out makes the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony. And I'm puzzled by your argument that that should not be a ground for the fourth element of the clear error system to be applied.
If, Mr. Gatt, let me follow up on that, because I think Judge DeMoss has a crucial point, and that's this. Once you cross over into a felony, the effects of a felony conviction as opposed to a misdemeanor conviction is extensive. And we're passing a line here that is that, you know, with this could be a crime. In fact, the next time she may be charged with career offender. I mean, and so there's really some real serious repercussions if we find that she was properly convicted of a felony in this case.
I would,
or at least it's not plain error. I'm sorry.
If we don't find that, how do we have the power to find that she was properly convicted of a misdemeanor?
I will attempt to answer your question first and work backwards. Absolutely. The evidence, and I appreciate...
You liked my question.
Yeah, you know.
It's easy. That said, absolutely the evidence in this case is ample to prove a misdemeanor. If you look at this court's recent decision in a case called Miller, which is a situation where a defendant placed his vehicle in reverse, he had been shot in the face and the car careened and assaulted officers. The court says, given that Miller intended the acceleration and knew the acceleration was likely to result in grave harm to the officers, Miller manifested the requisite level of intent for conviction. Of course, his ultimate motive was to escape, but probably not to injure the officers. But this does not vitiate his ability to intend, in a legal sense, the assault as an intermediate matter. Many cases, and you can look at Ramirez, it cites a litany of sorts of cases that are very similar. In this case, it's kind of, the way I read the record, she is forcibly resisting arrest. That is what she is doing. They are attempting to handcuff her. She jerks her arms. It's not as if she's just flailing and they walk into her arms. She is intentionally resisting arrest. If you read the record from beginning to end, she says, "You will not take me to jail."
There's enough evidence. I mean, there's simply enough evidence for the jury to.
At a base minimum, I believe that the record clearly supports Ms. Williams' conviction for two misdemeanor counts of assault as a benchmark. And working backwards, so let's look at the sentence that she received. She received 12 months on one count. If they were misdemeanors, she received a total of 21 months. So, if they were misdemeanors, the court could impose the exact same sentence, and in fact, the guidelines would direct the court to run the count consecutive, the second count consecutive, 9 months in this case, 12 on the first, 9 on the second.
Now, counsel, wait a minute. I've always been under the impression that if there is a statutory maximum, that becomes the guideline limit.
If there's only one count, that's correct. But in this case, since there are two counts, they have to run the second count consecutive to achieve.
They have to?
Well, shall.
What do you mean? I thought that was.
Now it is advisory, and clearly the district court has the discretion to do whatever it chooses. But should it apply the guidelines as they are written, they say the court shall run. So that if the court were to calculate correctly, as it's required to do, the advisory guideline range, it would still be the same.
Now, wait a minute. Go over that again.
If the court, in this case, with two misdemeanors, the advisory guideline range would not change.
The advisory guideline range would be 12 months max.
Per each count. But no, the advisory guideline range would stay the same. The statutory maximum for each count would be, in fact, limited to 12 months, and the court would run them consecutively to achieve punishment.
What statute indicates that the statutory max, when you have two convictions, is consecutive?
Guideline 5G1.
No. The statutory. I understand what the guideline. You know, you could stack the guidelines, okay? I understand that. But you have committed, let's just say you committed two misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. Assume that. And the statutory, not the guideline, but the statutory max is 1 year apiece.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you allowed to stack the statutory max so that when you have a guideline, you don't go over, is it 1 year or 2 years?
It's 1 year per count, and they can be run consecutive, I believe, 3553 and 3142, 18.
35 what? 53?
I'm trying to think if it's, I'll have to go back and get the exact, but clearly a district court can run counts consecutive and has complete discretion to do so. I'm sorry, it may be
I am familiar. I am familiar with the guidelines. I mean, you're absolutely correct with that. What I'm not familiar with is the statutory
authorization
to stack.
It's going to be from
1 year to 2 years.
It's going to be in the 3100 area, and I'll have to find the exact provision. I apologize for not having that at the tip of my tongue. But that said, if I review the pre-sentence report, sure, that reference might be in there. But in this case, the guideline range, I believe, would stay the same, except for the term of supervised release would in fact be limited to the 2 years as it was. So she cannot show that even if this court does not find the felony, and assuming that this court does remand to the district court for resentencing, her exposure is likely to be exactly the same.
Well, we would have to remand for it. Even in your scenario, we have to vacate the sentence, remand with instructions to impose, convictions, misdemeanor convictions.
Affirm the actually, this court would affirm the lesser included misdemeanor convictions.
But allow then the judge to resent.
That would be.
You agree to that?
Oh, absolutely not. Exactly. No. I was working backwards with your question and hoping to get back to my Cotton argument, which is that if we're looking at
you
substantial.
You don't agree that the conviction should be for two misdemeanors?
Applying Cotton, I have an argument, at least. I feel strongly that there was no manifest miscarriage of justice.
Okay.
And that,
okay,
that and I think I don't believe, and her sentence is one of the reasons why. Number two.
Where does manifest miscarriage of justice come from?
The substantial rights prong of the plain error analysis. And so there's two prongs, substantial rights and the fairness, integrity, and reputation of the judicial proceedings. In Cotton, the court didn't even address the substantial rights prong. It jumped to the fourth prong, which is the fairness reputation. Here, she was indicted by a grand jury. She had a district court judge. She had a 12-member jury. She had proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the bodily contact. I don't think there's really any dispute that the bodily contact occurred.
Sure.
All of those things are present in this case.
Except for... What about intention? What is there in the evidence?
The jury was instructed on intent, as Ms. Fuentes read the charge to this court, and the jury found that. They were absolutely required to find, as for conviction. And so whether it's the misdemeanor or...
Under a simple assault, there has to be intention to harm?
Intention to commit the act that results, in this case, resisting, Your Honor. In other words, there was no allegation, and I don't believe anybody believes, that the jury was improperly charged for the misdemeanor. In fact, the jury found all of the requisite elements.
So
the only element...
What you're suggesting, I think, is what you're suggesting, if this was properly instructed as a felony or the indictment, all that had to be added was...
Bodily contact. That's the only thing missing. Everything else is teed up and perfect, to be quite honest. And that is why I'm making the Cotton argument. Mr. Cotton went from a statutory maximum of 20 years, he ended up with life in prison based on his drug quantity. So I realize there is a collateral consequence of going from a misdemeanor to a felony. However, I don't believe in this case that it in any way that consequence is even remotely as grave as the consequence Mr. Cotton faced.
Well, perhaps.
Finally, as to the possibility that she might be subject to a three strikes rule, in the future, that's completely within her own whether she chooses to commit another crime or not is with her, within her control, and certainly not within anybody else's. That said, I understand this court's concern. I understand that Cotton did not deal with that narrow issue. And that narrow issue, as Judge DeMoss correctly pointed out, I don't believe a case exists to answer that question. And so that's going to be the difficult question this court is going to have to resolve, I believe, today. I think had it not been the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony, Cotton would clearly control.
No doubt, in my view.
So that is the fly in the ointment in this case.
Mr. Gay, the other aspect of this case, this is the inverse of Hazelwood.
Mm-hmm.
And I presume that there are no jurisdictional defects in, and I mean jurisdictional, that is to say that although it was alleged that it was a misdemeanor and although it was instructed as a misdemeanor, that the district judge and a grand jury could indict on a misdemeanor and could be tried in front of a federal judge. None of those cause any type of problems.
Absolutely.
You know, it obviously Hazelwood's the inverse, whether that there you do have all kinds of jurisdictional problems.
Absolutely. The district court, an Article III judge, can there are and is and. You know, it's interesting going back and reading Cotton, because I think that so many of us, you know, operate in this idea of jurisdiction, and yet now there really, most fundamentally, there are very few quote-unquote jurisdictional errors. In fact, Bain was expressly overruled by Cotton.
Sure.
And so in this case, procedurally, there are no jurisdictional hiccups.
Yeah, that was the other thing that, you know, having read Hazelwood, I immediately I know it's the inverse of it, but then the question is, are we still, is there some still problems with this thing? No, go ahead.
Yes.
Let me ask you, your argument is that she could be sentenced to two consecutive terms for the two convictions, misdemeanor convictions, statutory maximum for each one is 24 months, right?
12 months on each.
12 months.
12 months. I mean, 12 months,
yes.
Right? So that's a total of 24.
Right. She got.
But was she sentenced to 21?
She was. So she would be within the statutory maximum for
21 total?
Total. 21 total.
All right.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
So she's within the statutory maximum for the two counts?
Absolutely.
And if you don't
but only because
counts,
they were concurrent.
Have convictions for two counts, right?
You can have, well, assuming they were felonies, they ran concurrent, so she was sentenced
to... assuming they weren't.
Assuming they weren't, you would run them, count one would run consecutive to count two. Okay.
Does the fact that you had two victims implicate your analysis, or could you also have one victim hit twice?
If you had one victim hit twice, it would be one count.
Okay,
yes,
great. So
absolutely.
Because you have the two people, that separates the counts and separates the punishment for two separate distinct acts.
And there were two discrete forcibly resisted. Each of them attempted to subdue, and each of them suffered the bodily contact. There were two discrete events.
Any discussion of upward departure?
I believe that the district court was satisfied that a within-guideline range sentence, I believe they requested for a below-guideline sentence, and the court declined that invitation.
And the government took that position.
I think the government requested a within-guideline sentence, is my recollection of the record, Your Honor. And in this case, if there are no further questions, I'll sum up our position. We, number one, strongly believe that we proved both the felony and the lesser-included misdemeanor assaults in this case. Number two, we believe that the Supreme Court's opinion in Cotton gives this court a roadmap for which it could affirm the convictions and sentence in this case. I do not believe that the sentences in this case resulted in a manifest miscarriage of justice, and I do not believe that the fairness and integrity of the judicial proceedings were affected for all the reasons that I had previously stated. Finally, should this court disagree, we respectfully request the court to enter a judgment of conviction affirming the judgments of conviction on counts 1 and 2 and to remand to the district court for resentencing.
As misdemeanors.
As misdemeanors.
And remand?
For resentencing.
Gotcha. Thank you very much, Ms. Kennedy. Ms. Fuentes.
I'll start out on the point on which I agree with Mr. Gay, and that is if the court finds the evidence sufficient, and we vigorously dispute that,
sure.
But if the court finds the evidence sufficient, then I think the proper course is to vacate, affirm the convictions as misdemeanors, vacate the sentences, and remand for resentencing. And I think I have to disagree with Mr. Gay on substantial rights adversely affecting the integrity and fairness of the proceedings. With substantial rights, the court could decide to stack those sentences, to run them consecutive. That's true. But he can't impose 21 months on each count. The sentence will have to be changed. He is limited to 1 year. So the outcome, there is more than a reasonable probability that the outcome will be different if this case is sent back.
This was 21 months on each count concurrent.
Correct. And so the sentence will have to be different. And I think that as troubling as the misdemeanor felony distinction is to this court, I think it may have the same effect on the district court. I don't know whether the district court would be so disposed to impose such a high sentence for two misdemeanors. In addition, as we've noted in our opening brief, we asked for a downward variance because of Mrs. Williams' various problems and that she could be treated better with a non-prison sentence. And the court said at the beginning of sentencing, I see you've asked for a variance. It's not a good day for that. And I think that, given the circumstances of this case as a whole, it is more fair, and it, I think, is required by justice to send the case back and let the district court decide what the proper sentence is. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fuentes. Ms. Fuentes and Mr. Gay, you know, obviously you need to tell your people in El Paso that this is not –